session is solving the problems of how to solve, how to, problem solving for staying an active person or becoming an active person. And I've invited my wife, Jonette, to come and sort of co-chair this session. She's a marathon runner, and she has solved a lot of problems, or been through a lot of problems. To run at the level that she runs, you have to do a lot of problem solving. And I'm very, very, very good from starting at practically zero activity, getting people up to medium and moderate activity. And I think that for the upper level of activity, that she has some insights that will really be helpful, and probably some insights helpful for everybody. I like to latch onto her glory by thinking myself a part of Team Jonette when she runs. But
I haven't solved any of my own problems. He solved them.
I paid her a lot to say that. I put the names of some books on the board, which I hope you can read it. Your Money or Your Life is the essence of the book is his premise is that time and money is essentially the same thing, and that unless you're independently wealthy, you have to trade time for money, and that it's a look at materialism from that lens, and that is that that before you buy something or make a financial commitment, what everybody always says they need is more time, and it's just a way of looking at that exchange between time and money. The Inner Game of Tennis is a really wonderful book. It's not just helpful for tennis alone. It's helpful for people who are trying to learn any kind of a sport, and it's an approach to learning sports. I'll talk about it a little bit, but it has quite a bit in common with The Drawing from the Right Side of the Brain, which is by Betty Edwards. Both of them are talking about using a right brain shift, or trying to use the right side of your brain, the non-logical side of your brain, to learn how to do a sport, to problem solve. It also helps a lot. I use it trying to learn how to play a musical instrument. It's a way of turning off the critical side, the part of you that's saying, oh, you're stupid, if you don't hit a better serve than that, your wife's going to get, you know, run off and get married to the tennis pro, this kind of thing. And for people who, I really do believe that sport is a very, very valuable thing to have in your life, and it's very good at helping people solve a lot of the frustration that goes along with sports. And the last book is Covert Bailey's The New Fit or Fat, or even The Old Fit or Fat was a really good book. And this is a lot of the material I presented last time, and the basic concept is there's many, many reasons that diets don't work. Probably the largest reason is that the human body is genetically evolved to respond to a time of plenty of food by eating what food is available, because our bodies evolved over thousands and thousands and thousands of years where there were episodes of feast and famine. So the reason that we eat more than we should eat does not necessarily mean that we're bad people. It's what you're genetically programmed to do, and also that we're programmed to like the foods that are the richest in calories, animal fats, meats, and also things that taste sweet, which have a lot of energy packed in them. We're also genetically programmed to store extra energy, whereas if you're a hunter-gatherer, you've got to be moving a lot of the time. You don't have any way to preserve food, and even if you could preserve it, you can't store it. Somebody that's a hunter-gatherer cannot load up 20 sacks of grain on his back and take off walking around. The efficient way to store it is right here. And that's the way our bodies are designed. And Americans are existing in a very long period of a feast. And we're doing basically what we're genetically programmed to do. He also talks about the famine response, which in people in the poorer parts of the world, that is when you lose about 10% of your body fat, your metabolism slows down very, very far. And that means that you actually consume calories very much slower. This is a survival mechanism. And the way that most Americans experience this famine response is in dieting, particularly severe dieting, where you try to rapidly lose weight. What usually happens is people very rapidly lose about down to about 10% of their body weight and then become very, very, very hungry and also feel very lethargic and don't feel like moving around very much. The antidote of this is to increase the amount of aerobic activity, which gradually over a period of time builds up the amount of aerobic muscle you have, which allows you, my metaphor is to move from somebody who's driving a Volkswagen, you know, which you can drive around town, and it burns very, very little gas, up to maybe a GTO with a 427 four-barrel carburetor. You know, so the more aerobic muscle you have, the more you can burn off calories, or the faster you can burn them off. Today what I'd like to cover, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about rest. And then I want to move into a little bit of information about the importance of sports and how to go about if you've never played a sport before or if you're playing sports and you feel really frustrated about it. I'd like to give a little information about maybe how to get more satisfaction out of it or how to get started at a sport. And after that, I'm hoping that I would like to do case histories to help people solve problems. And I'm hoping that you'll be willing to come forward and just tell me, for example, if you've always been an active person, maybe what obstacles you've had and how you've solved them, or what your strategy is for maintaining your activity level as you get older. If you've never been active and you'd like to just kind of get if you'd be willing to share that with us, and we can kind of go through and use whoever's willing to talk as a model. Or if you've experienced an injury or something's happened to you and that you used to be active and are having difficulty getting back to it, we can also go through that in sort of a problem-solving way, which I think as we go through this problem-solving method, it's not the individual cases I'd like you to remember, but what I'd like you to hopefully learn is this problem-solving method for maintaining activity. So before we launch into the idea of rest, I'd like you to take just a minute and close your eyes, and I'm going to say two words to you, and I want you to meditate just for a few moments about each word, and actually phrase, and tell me what, and then afterwards we'll talk about it. You just think of the images that will come to your mind, and the first word is weekend. Think about what images come to mind. And then think about the word Sabbath. Is anybody willing to share the images that come to mind?
Mental rest and rest.
For both?
Yeah.
For both the weekend and the Sabbath.
And family, and then even more busier. Sabbath only because of choir, bell choir, Sunday school. There's a lot of things happening, so it seems busier.
So Sabbath is a busy day. Yeah. Anybody else? Anybody?
Well, Sunday for me is a church and a day of rest because my exercise program is a 6-day program. And I just take, and even if I get off because of weather or something else, I'll take one day off.
Good. Okay, so for some people it seems like the image of the weekend and the Sabbath is just about the same. For other people it seems like the Sabbath evokes a lot of, for you it seems like the image of the Sabbath evokes a lot of activity. And I think for me personally, when I think of a weekend, a lot of times I think of a lot of frenzied activity. We have kids, you know, so we think about baseball games, soccer games, things like that. And when I think of the Sabbath, it makes me think sort of biblically and sort of Old Testamentally, and I think to what we don't completely have anymore, which is the Sabbath is truly as a day of rest. And we had a course last week, which was looking at the Sabbath from the Jewish perspective, and it's interesting to see how. And if you go back and read the text in Exodus, there are actually more words and descriptions of the Sabbath and exactly how to keep the commandment about the Sabbath than there are about any of the other commandments. I mean, there's thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not lie, et cetera, et cetera. But there's this long prescription about the Sabbath, that you're not to work yourself, you're not to work your animals, that you're to prepare foods in advance so that your wife doesn't have to cook dinner, this kind of thing. And if you think about, you know, the complaints of people who live in our modern world, it's the idea of a Sabbath is, you know, it's something that seems like, at least in my meditation about it, seems like something that's that could really be helpful, you know, that it truly is a day of rest. And this ties into exercise and activity because rest is one part of being an active person. One of the people who was in the course, the Sabbath course, last week, was quite an elderly woman. You know, we were talking about, people were, you know, talking about the modern weekend and what you do, and she held her hand up. She was actually a little bit angry. She says, you know, when people did hard physical work all day, you needed to have Sunday, and you needed to have it to rest, or else you got so worn down and you got sick. And not only that, you had to rest your animals. The animals had to have, you know, this was the days when plows and wagons and things were pulled by animals, and the animals needed to have the rest. And she actually told a story which, that they were, you know, in the days when people were migrating to the west, that these wagon trains would start out from the east, and they had to get over the mountain passes in the west before the snow came, or they would either starve on the plains, or they would get mired down in the snow going over the mountain pass. And there were two wagon trains that were behind. They were behind the schedule of where they should be. And one of them decided to give up resting on the seventh day, that generally they stopped on the seventh day. And the other wagon train decided to press on and just go 7 days a week because they were afraid they wouldn't arrive on time. And the thing that was interesting is that the train that stopped every seventh day and rested actually got there first. And probably mostly because of fatigue of the animals, but also because the people just were fatigued. Now, I want to make a really one definite point, which is, in general, I think in modern times we've really lost track of how much the human body is capable of. And I definitely don't advocate rest as an antidote to most of the problems. You know, to particularly not the painful problems, you know, knee problems, ankle problems, shoulder problems. Almost never the answer to these problems is rest. But I do want to look at the role of rest and as it relates to exercise, partly because when you're exercising, you are breaking down little pieces of muscle tissue are actually breaking down. If you have a good strenuous workout, you lose a little bit of muscle tissue. And if you were actually to measure the amount of muscle tissue that you have in your body after you do a strenuous workout, you'd have a little less than you started out with. And that releases chemicals in your blood that actually triggers your body through the night to actually rebuild muscle. And so the next day you'll wind up with a little bit more than you had the day before. Okay? But sleep is extremely important for people that are being physically active. Because if you do not have the sleep, your muscles will not repair themselves, and you have the buildup of these, the lactic acid and other chemicals in your body. What we think happens is when you reach the level of sleep where you're dreaming. Have you ever seen a dog that's laying? They're going to go woof, 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 like that, kind of running in its sleep. This happens to humans too. Is that you have a dream? You're dreaming and your muscles are having these little tiny flickering contractions, which has the effect of kind of milking the muscle. It's a very light contraction. It milks the blood through the muscle, improves the circulation, and then the muscles go through periods where a very, very deep relaxation where circulation is able to be restored. And people who don't get deep sleep or who don't sleep over long, long periods of time start to develop multiple muscle pain all over their bodies. That can become very, very severe. And this is basically what we would call fibromyalgia. And there's several other related syndromes, like chronic fatigue syndrome, that are related to not sleeping. Sleeping is really important. The other way this applies to exercise is we talked the other day about different, you know, ways of exercising. And if you're doing something like an hour of very light aerobic exercise every day, such as walking or some easy cycling, something like that. You don't really need to worry on a day-to-day basis about, you can do that every day or most days, and you can do it quite safely. However, if you move up into more strenuous activities, like playing a strenuous sport, or if you're actually running or you're cycling at a faster pace, where you're working one group of muscles and working it pretty much to fatigue in the course of your workout, you do need to rest. It's better not to have two really strenuous days for the same group of muscles in a row. And this can be solved in various ways. You can have easy days and light days. You can, you know, one day you can, if you're a runner, you can run a long run or a fast run, and the next day you can run slower and easier. It doesn't have to be absolute rest, but it does need to be a relative rest compared. Like, if you're running 2 miles, you maybe should not run at all the next day. If you're running, generally running 7 or 8 miles, a 1 or 2 mile run might be a rest day for you. But in relative terms, you do need to have some easier days. And it also brings up the idea of cross training, which is having a variety of, if you're going to be doing strenuous activities, for example, you might run one day, which heavily works the hip extensors and the hamstrings, and cycle the next day, which doesn't work the hip extensors as much as it works the quadriceps and the front part of your thigh. So you're actually, you're varying the strain on the muscles. Does that all make sense? Is there any questions about that part, about the rest?
I might add just that one way to, a couple of ways to monitor whether you're overdoing it would be if you've started a program or you've increased a program and you're noticing that you're not sleeping as well at night. I mean, you might want to check some other things. Are you drinking more caffeine? Are you stressed out at work or whatever? But actually, exercise should counterbalance some of the effects of stress at work. But if you know that you have significantly increased your exercise program and you're also now having trouble sleeping is a symptom of overuse or overdoing it. So that's one. The other thing is that if you take your resting heart rate in the morning before you get up, if you find that your resting heart rate is actually going up instead of down, then that's also a symptom of overtraining. So that will tell you that you need to slow down a little bit, to back off. You've stepped up too far too fast.
I would also say the other two signs would be if you're getting a lot of illnesses, because strenuous activity does momentarily lower your immune system, your immune response. And also, in addition to sleeplessness, excessive sleepiness. Like if you're finding you're working out 3 or 4 days in a row and you find that you just are feeling dead tired, absolutely exhausted, like you just got to fall asleep, that's also a symptom that you're overworking.
Yeah, particularly if it's a time of day that you wouldn't generally feel sleepy. I mean, I think we all get kind of a 2 o'clock sleepy thing, but or at least I do. But if it's a time where you really are battling sleepiness during the day, then yeah, that's unusual for you.
Yeah, I had some questions about the cross training regimen. Both of the examples that you gave were ones that are from the hip down.
Lower extremity.
Cycling. If you were to mix cycling or running with a rowing machine.
Perfect, yeah.
They're both aerobic. How about the aerobic with weights? That kind of alternate.
Overtraining in weights is a really different issue, and that really has to do with when you're doing weight training, your goal is actually, in order to trigger that increase of increasing the size and strength of your muscles, you actually have to exhaust the muscle. And so the big thing about weightlifting is you just don't want to do it. You don't want to do maximum weightlifting 2 or 3 days in a row. You want to put a day in between.
And that can be your aerobic day. So you could do your aerobic day, you go run or cycle or row or whatever, and then your strength training, upper body, you know, weightlifting.
You can do it on the
then
same
you could
day,
run right? again. Well, you could actually even do it on the same day, but sometimes if we don't have enough time, that is a nice way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do your aerobic stuff one day, your weightlifting the next day, aerobics, weight.
And if you had that, and we're talking about working in a Sabbath too, which is a very important thing, and you got a 6-day cycle, is 3 times in 7 days enough for aerobic benefit? Is it enough for weight or benefit?
That's a really good question. And the way you have to think of it is of a scale, okay? Aerobic exercise 2 days a week is the minimum that does any good. If you're not getting at least 20 minutes of aerobic exercise 2 days a week, you're not maintaining, you'll actually start to lose aerobic fitness over time, okay? If you're getting 20 minutes of aerobic exercise 3 times a week, you will begin to gradually increase your aerobic capacity, okay? Now, this is the minimum. This is like the bottom of what is absolutely physically necessary for basic good health. From there, it depends a lot on what you want to do. For example, and what your goals are. For example, if your big goal is to reduce the percentage of your body that's fat, exercising 3 20-minute periods of exercise is not going to do that for you, probably. You should really be looking at about 40 minutes to an hour, probably 5 days a week, in order to really make a significant impact on your body fat over a period of time. Or to look at it a different way, let's say you have a particular goal in mind. Like, for example, you wanted to hike from Darrington over to Holden Village this summer. Those 3 20-minute periods of aerobic exercise just wouldn't be enough for that. It has to be somewhat proportional for what it is that you'd like to either for some medical goal or some physical goal you're shooting for, or for some event or some effort in the future that you're going to try.
Although, if I had 6 days to work with, and I wanted to balance aerobic with strength, and I wasn't specificity training, which means that I specifically want to run a marathon, and so I need to run in order to run a marathon. That's called specificity training. Am I saying that word right? You train specifically for what your end goal is. So if you're just if you want to maintain or increase fitness, but you're not training for a certain event, 2 times a week weightlifting will maintain strength. And so if I had 6 days to work with and I want to do one or the other every day, I would do aerobics 4 times and strength training 2x. And then you would be increasing aerobic fitness and you would also be maintaining or increase. I've always heard that 2 times a week in terms of strength training is sufficient.
Not just to maintain. At 2 times a week, if you're doing maximum weightlifting, you'll have an increase in your muscle.
In particular, maybe on a third day at home, you'd be willing to add in a set of push-ups just on your bedroom floor and some sit-ups. You know, maybe you won't go to the gym that day and do free weights, but you'll just do those things, easy things at home that take 10 minutes.
And is designing, sorry to dominate.
Oh, that's okay.
You're
an authentic volunteer. That's what we're hoping for.
What you just brought up, let's say you do an hour at the gym a day and your regimen is in the morning and that sort of thing. Should you let 24 hours go? Can you do something in the evening of the same day? What's the...
You mean aerobic, like both aerobic? Aerobic? Some people do run 2x a day or cycle 2x a day. Okay. It's better, like if you have 6 days to work with and you know that you're going to go on vacation the last 3 days of the week, I wouldn't suggest doing 3 2-a-days to make up for,
sure,
because they're too crammed together. But if you're high level and you can, I wouldn't suggest to somebody just beginning to go out and do these 2 periods a day. If you're already there, what you want to do is, you would take your entire exercise time and break it in half. Half in the morning, half in the evening. And they're actually finding that has the same benefit as doing it all together at once. Some studies are. And I can't exactly say at what point, like, does that have to be an hour broken in half, or does a half an hour broken in half do the same thing? I don't think so. I think each session has to be at least 20 minutes long, preferably half an hour long.
For those of you that weren't here last time.
Answer your question?
It does. Good.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
You just, the more you can spread it out, in other words, you don't want to, if you only have 4 days a week, you don't want to do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then nothing at all until Monday again, if you can help it. It's better to go Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, or something like that, you know.
But never on Sunday.
Actually, so I do take Sundays off too, and I like that from anything.
Well, yeah, just incidentally, for people, you know, this came up in the discussion of the Sabbath, but the purpose, I mean, the intention, the original intention of the Sabbath is that it's to be a gift to humanity. And somebody said, well, you know, if you're actually a person who sits at a desk all week, that rest for you may very well be to be doing something physical. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very good comment.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was. If you're at the YMCA, if they have these certain fitness machines, and you can fit the tension, you know, to probably your age and your weight and so on, is it better to have more tension and less repetitions, or more repetitions and less tension? Because you're going to get very tired either way.
Right. It's a complicated answer, but let's just say to start out, I guess the first question is, what's your goal? What are you trying to accomplish?
To keep the muscles.
Keep muscle mass.
Tone.
Mm-hmm. Tone.
Uh-huh.
Not build muscles, but tone.
Mm-hmm. Most exercise machines are designed, they're very carefully thought out and designed to isolate muscles so that you work one muscle
all different machines,
at a time, right. And they're designed really to, what they're really designed for is to give people that really, you know, what the kids call cut-looking muscles. That's where your muscles have extremely good definition.
And it's a little one, because,
right.
Yeah.
And there are some problems with the way, with these machines for people who are older than 30 or 40 years old. And the problems, particularly if you're using them with the highest level of tension, because the fastest way to get the biggest muscle is to exercise, you do three repetitions at enough tension so that after 10 repetitions, you're absolutely tired. You could not do the 11th. So it's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, and at the 10th one, you actually could not do 11, and you do 3 sets at that amount of tension. That's the best way to build the biggest muscle the quickest. However, for people who are, you know, past 30 or 40 years old, what happens is particularly in the shoulders, is the tendons of the rotator cuff muscles gradually thin out and get weaker, and the reasons for this are kind of complicated, but just take my word for it that they do. And the possibility of a rotator cuff tear as you get older, it's about 15 or 20% of cadavers when they dissect them have rotator cuff tears, whether they ever knew it or not. And the thing that is difficult is that you're most likely to get a rotator cuff tear when you exactly isolate a muscle, particularly the rotator cuff muscles. So it's actually, if you're going to be, if number one, free weights are much safer than exercise machines because they don't isolate the muscles as exactly. And it's actually better and more physiological to exercise the muscles out of those absolute anatomical planes. It's better to exercise them in diagonal planes than in the exact planes. It's also much, much safer to have an amount of weight on that, so that you would be fatiguing at 30 to 40 repetitions versus at 10.
That answers my question.
Yeah.
You still get, what you don't get out of that is the bulk of the muscle, but what you do get is the toning and the improving of your muscle mass, and it's much, much, much safer.
Well,
the other thing about exercise machines is that the exercise machines provide the stability for the joint while you exercise it. And one of the things that you see, I see all the time in people who have their great big muscles, is you'll see a guy on a machine and he'll go like this with it, with, you know, to show this great big huge bicep. But if you watch, his scapula slides forward because he's never developed the stabilizing muscles of the scapula. And this causes, you know, a whole other set of problems. The nice thing about free weights is that you have to also develop the supporting muscles. For the upper extremity, it's developing the muscles that rotate and stabilize your scapula while you're lifting like this.
Well, and people get into trouble on those machines a lot because, and this is the way Mitch described it to me, and it makes a lot of sense. Your shoulder always works as a group of muscles together in the real world. I pick up this time a whole bunch of a group of muscles working together. Never is just this one teeny, and I don't know the names of the muscles, you know, going to be asked to work all by itself. So it's like trying to lift a weight with your pinky instead of your whole hand. You know, you're isolating it, a muscle that isn't meant to be worked in isolation, and people end up in a lot of trouble. I have lots of friends that have little nagging things because they just go to town on those machines and they're not using their muscles as groups the way that they're intended to be used.
The problem for the lower extremity is that the knee is very stressful on the cartilage of the kneecap to have maximum weightlifting through a large arc of motion. And most of these, is doing this kind of exercise will develop your quadricep, but it also really accelerates the wearing out of the cartilage under your kneecap, and which can be a really big problem. So,
could you help?
Yeah, I have a question. What's the optimum amount of time to wait between sets?
Pardon me? Just a few minutes. What you actually want to do for weightlifting is build the lactic acid up as quick as you can. So you do a set to fatigue, wait a little bit.
Until full recovery, like until your muscle doesn't feel tired anymore. Yeah.
And 2 or 3 minutes, you say?
No, not even that.
Or if you're doing a rotation around things, you can just do one set. By the time you rotate back to that spot, you'd be ready to work that group again.
And then back to your question, the only thing I wouldn't do combining aerobic exercise and weight training on the same day is exercise the same muscle group. So like if you've gone on a bicycle ride and you just worn your quadriceps out bicycle riding, I wouldn't do weightlifting for your quads the same way.
Right. Yeah.
But you could totally have out the upper extremity and you could do all your upper extremity and you'd be fine.
And then you could take the next day completely off from
there. Yeah.
See, people do that. Combine them so they have a full, entire day off the next day. And every other day exercise is sufficient. I mean, every other day is. And I found at certain times in my life when my kids were little, I would train for half marathons during that time. And I ran every other day. I did not run every day. And I even kept my mileage. Probably I didn't go over like 25 miles a week. And I was easily able to run half marathons training at that level. So every other day is really a nice amount.
No question. Having grown up being a soccer player, a skier, my sports are all lower extremities. I've never lifted weights or anything. What kind of stuff for upper body? Is a rowing machine a good, like, overall kind of workout?
Well, I guess the question again is, the first thing is, what is it you want to accomplish? Because if you're an active person, you may not have to do anything. You know, if you have to think, okay, is there something right now that I'm trying to do that I find really difficult to do? Like, for example, if you tell me that, generally everything you can do is fine, that's great. On the other hand, if you say, well, you know, what I like to do once every 3 or 4 weeks is go mountain climbing or rock climbing, then I think, okay, well, he's got to have heavy, you know, every once in a while he needs a lot of strength. So for you, a weight training program might be appropriate. But it is really not completely necessary to do weight training unless there is something that you're having difficulty doing.
I was thinking I don't really feel like I want to weight train, but I want to do something that exerts it the way I've experienced with the sports I play are exerting my legs.
Well, and having talked to you and knowing that you run some upper body strengthening. And maybe that's just for people like me who have none naturally. Maybe you have enough naturally, but upper body strengthening in a light, you don't want to add a lot of mass because the lighter you are, the less you have to carry. But it can also benefit things like running.
But like a rowing machine, I guess my question is that a decent, like, enough of a upper body kind of workout to exercise those enough?
That'll give you some upper body benefit.
Yeah.
And like Mitch is saying, as long as you're not trying to row so that you can go mountain climb. You know,
right.
If you're rowing for general upper body strength,
shoulders,
or swimming,
arm,
I don't know if you're a swimmer, but swimming is great for upper body also, but yeah.
The rowing machine has the nice benefit of rowing is that it does strengthen the scapula retractors, which that's a hard group to find some way to exercise. Yeah. However, I would say about rowing machine is that if you're after a feeling of bulk and increasing the size of the muscles, a rowing machine won't do it because it's mostly aerobic. It will give you the sense of being toned, But it's not going to really do much to increase the mass of the muscle.
I would really like to just fatigue some of the upper body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And rowing machine would be great for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, for looking around in the room, quite a few people are in my position, trying to maintain my quality of life mm-hmm. by being fit. And of course, and I mentioned this to you, I think, on our first thing, is I can't find any real fitness books or manuals or anything for people over 65.
Probably because the principles of exercise don't really change with age. But people over 65, your muscles will respond to exercise the same way that mine will, or the same way that somebody who's 30 years old will.
But what I'm looking for is being able to come up to Holden for a week, go on a hike, and then not be able to meet the bell the next morning.
Okay. Let's do this then. Let's use you for a little case study.
Are you willing to use us for a case study? Okay.
Okay, so this will be kind of quick, but do you mind telling us how old you are?
75.
Okay, 75. Good. And what was your, the next thing is just to get kind of a survey of how active he is just generally. So generally, how do you spend your day? What do you?
I'm active. I'm retired. I weigh the same as I did when I was, 25, 30.
What are your activities? Like, what are you actually doing all day?
Walking, gardening. I do free weights. In a very modest way.
Okay.
I have a trampoline that I use on rainy days.
I would say right away you're doing very well.
And the problem there is people have told me that, hey, trampolines don't do you any good. Well, I know this. I have some arthritis in my knees, mm-hmm. and I can jog without any discomfort at all mm-hmm. on that 40 inch or whatever it is trampoline.
Okay, good. So when you how much time do you think you spend walking every week?
I walk at least 15 miles a week.
And how long do you think that takes you in time? Much more.
I try to approach a 15-minute mile.
15-minute miles. And how many miles a week did you say?
15 miles.
What
was that? Yeah. Like on your daily walk, how long are you out?
Well, I have a number of different routes, uh-huh. but I walk between 2 and 4 miles.
Okay.
And that takes you about an hour.
Every other day, because I don't walk right. like that.
So between a half an hour and an hour or more, you walk every day.
Let's just say 4 to 5 hours of walking, and how much time a week do you think you spend on the trampoline?
Oh, very little if the weather's good.
So you do that instead of you do that.
I do that instead okay. when for one reason or another.
Good.
The walking isn't.
Okay. And the goal? What is it you'd like to accomplish? I want to be really clear about what your goal is.
Well, I would just like to stop deterioration of my strength, general strength.
Okay. So you feel like your ability to do things is going down?
Well, it's harder for me to keep up with a hiking party. You know.
Okay, so it's the speed of hiking, for example, right? And you would like to be able to hike. You would like to.
I can slow down and go all day.
Yeah, but, is that right? Okay,
but you'd like to walk a little faster.
Trying to keep up with a group is.
Okay, when you're hiking, what would you say is it that slows you down? Is that you're excessively out of breath, or is it more that your muscles feel tired, or is it more that your joints feel achy?
A little bit of all.
Do you feel excessively out of breath?
No, never. In fact,
I
stop for a rest, I always take my pulse to make sure where I am.
Okay. With this amount of, and this is just for everybody, with this amount of, this, what you're doing is fantastic. I mean, what you're already doing is way, way more than most people do. And what you're already doing is entirely adequate to maintain your health. So, number one, you're doing very, very, very well, okay? So, I would be amazed if you're walking, you know, 4 to 5 hours a week already. I would be amazed if the thing that's really slowing you up on the hike is your lack of aerobic ability.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying it's not, because you're not.
And you're not feeling out of breath. So the other two possibilities, or the questions in my mind right now, is an issue of strength of your thigh, of your leg muscles, or is it an issue of joint pain? Are you having some joint pain?
What I wonder is, does your walk have any hills in it?
Most of the routes are downhill and then uphill, some of them.
Yeah.
So you do have hills. I mean, it's all, but you don't.
Generally, I mean, just like about hiking trail.
But one of the things that's difficult is, you know, this again is that concept of specificity of training. It's like when you're training to do something, you'd like to be doing. You'd like to be doing something as close to it as you can possibly get. And one of the things is that walking on your running or jogging on your trampoline and walking on level ground or walking, you know, on ground that's even gently rolling, is that you're going to be working your hamstrings and you're going to be working your quads a little bit, but you're not going to work your hip extensors very much at all.
Do people know where those muscles are? Okay. This is your hamstring back here. These are your quadriceps on your front. And your hip extensors,
that's the gluteals, the great big.
And where are your hip flexors?
The hip flexors are on the inside,
Those are kind of the four major ones up here.
So one thing I would suggest for you would be that you need to develop your hip, that would probably make you feel more peppy, particularly on the uphill part of the trail. Is it the uphill or the downhill that you think you lose the speed on?
I don't know. I find going downhill much harder on my knees.
Yeah, I don't doubt that it's harder on your knees. How about the feeling that you just can't walk as fast? Do you feel like that's the uphill part where you're lagging behind everybody else?
Well, what I'm saying is when I walk my normal pace, not trying to hurry, I'm not walking as fast as the normal people.
Yeah.
Okay. So one thing I would suggest, and particularly as it relates to hiking, is and also as it relates to speed, because the faster you walk, as you walk faster, you start to need your hip extensors more and more. And then when you actually start to run, you're using your hip extensors a lot. So one possible thing would be to increase the strength of your hip extensors, and that would be something like that would be the easiest way to do that would be to walk uphill. You know, in other words, take some routes that are definitely all uphill. But the other way you can do it is to ride an exercise bike.
Okay.
Does that work with like a recumbent bike?
Not as well.
I have a rowing machine that I
A rowing machine will help your hip extensors very much. Yeah. And this is where I'm getting at. What I'm really trying to hit here is the idea of you know, solving a problem, or what is it you're trying to accomplish? You know, because the rowing machine will help your upper body strength, but it's not going to help you hike faster. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
so will an exercise bike or a bike do the same thing?
A bicycle will do the same thing, yeah. Now, the other thing.
Both exercise and a regular bike. You can be doing either or. Was that your question?
Well, yeah, you had said use an exercise bike.
Right. The reason I say an exercise bike is that riding a regular bicycle, you have to work harder to do it. For example, you'd have to have a bike with gears so that you could be pushing as hard going on the level and the downhill as you are going uphill. And you'd have to know a little bit about cycling, how to do that. But an exercise bike, you can just turn the tension up and you can get a nice exercise for your hip extensors on the exercise bike. Now the other thing is you're saying that your knees are bothering you. And the possibility that you have arthritis in your knee is absolutely, you know, probably that's the case. One thing that we know, besides having total knees or things like that really helps, is to develop your quadricep muscles more. Now, on the downhill part of hiking, when you're hiking downhill, it's the quadricep, this front muscle that works, And if that's the one that controls the kneecap, and a lot of what people call arthritic pain in the knee, this pain on the inside of the knee is just because the kneecap is not stabilized very well by the quadricep. So some specific exercise for that is called a straight leg raise. And that's when you just lay on your back, put some weight on your foot.
Right. I do that as part of my light weight.
And you'd actually want to do that with heavy weight. You'd want to try to get to the idea of a 10 rep maximum. In other words, you'd want to have enough weight on there so after you did 10 of them, you'd be really tired.
Okay.
Trouble
doing that uphill. Okay. Strengthening the hip extensors is going to help you a lot on the uphill.
If you had, in order to not change your route, if you can picture, two times a week, if there's a particular hill, and you repeated walking that hill, you know, instead of just going up at once, but then you got to the top, walk back up.
I could do that.
Yeah,
I
you could add some hill reps right. into it, and that would help a lot.
What about, like, a day pack?
Yeah, you could also...
people who wear day packs to train for when they go hiking. Like, right. So when you go hiking, you wear a day pack or something with water in it.
That's an excellent strategy.
Yeah, simulating the experience as closely as you can. So yeah, adding a pack or something that you would be carrying to try to simulate the experience would be great.
Okay. You know, the only other thing I could suggest that you might look at that has to do with the speed of walking is increasing your stride length. That is, how many strides you can take. And you could do that by, this kind of stretching part, like this, and also just by deliberately, when you're walking, increasing your stride length, okay? So my total exercise...
If you can read it.
My recommendations
for him would be, he's already doing quite a bit of aerobic activity. He should supplement that by either walking uphill. He could trade some of that aerobic, either add it or trade it, would be riding an exercise bike with the tension moderately high so that he's exercising his hip extensors. He could add some straight leg raises to strengthen his thighs. That will help him on the downhill part of hiking, and it will also, perhaps, there's a good chance that it will reduce the joint pain that he's having in the knee. Very often, you can, you know, when the arthritis is moderate, you can reduce joint pain by increasing the strength of the quadricep muscle and work on increasing your stride length.
Okay. One question I have is does it do any good to take a couple of ibuprofen before you?
It could help you when you're doing something that's out of your usual, like when you're up here hiking. Yeah, you might want to take some before you go and take some afterwards, yeah. And also, you could also, a lot of joint pain, you can short-circuit the joint pain by putting a little compression on the joint, so an ACE wrap. That's actually the most important thing, and after the ACE wrap, would be putting some ice on it, right after you do it, okay? That's for people who are suffering arthritic pain, because a lot of the, whenever you have swelling in a joint, there are chemicals in that swelling that make the nerve endings much more sensitive. And so you'll reduce that pain if you can keep the swelling from happening in the first place.
Okay. Either wrap it or ice it.
No, I would...
Wrap first.
Compression is the very most important thing. And after that would be icing.
Okay.
I
have a question that's related to joint pain, but I have a problem with bursitis in my hip.
Okay.
And it was an injury 20 years ago.
Right. Okay, so she's... The problem she has is bursitis in the NI, and let's just get a, can we do you?
Yeah.
We'll go.
Why didn't I write?
Okay, good. My mother told me when I grew up, if I didn't learn how to spell better, nobody would take me seriously.
Don't laugh at me, though, because I am somewhat better than he is.
That must be my problem. I can change grade, I can't spell very well.
Good. Okay, so, let's just say, how old are you?
44.
And what's your occupation?
Training program specialist.
So is it? It's for my purpose. It's mostly sedentary.
Is it desk work?
Desk work.
But then I also do a lot of training. So I do lifting boxes of materials.
Occasional
lifting.
Good.
Oh, okay.
And do you do any, are you doing any exercise now?
Yeah, I walk 3 miles twice a week, and then I ride my, I have a recumbent, that's why I asked you, I have a recumbent exercise bike that I do at least like 20 minutes one day.
Okay, so you're getting 3 periods and then, of exercise a week.
So 3 miles of walking on level and hills.
Okay, and in addition to that, your bike?
I have a recumbent bike.
So how many more times a week do you do that?
I would say one at this point.
One other time.
I used to do the Y 3 days a week with the weight training and then the elliptical trainer.
Uh-huh.
That would be like a 45-minute. The elliptical, I go 45.
Okay, so in your head, the amount that you're doing right now, is your hip bothering you?
Well, it's just when I'm, not since here, but when it's like a 3-day-a-week walk, it depends on what I'm doing, like if I'm doing lifting or if I, like you were talking earlier about doing a little bit more.
Right.
And it just snaps and pops and I lose the...
Okay, so tell me what you would, so let's think about, if you're thinking about becoming more active, is it more that you feel like your hip is holding you back and you would like to be able to do more than you can do now?
Well, I have 2 things that are holding me back, but yes, my hip does hold me back.
What's the other thing that's holding you back?
You talked about the shoulder injury, and I did, and I had a frozen shoulder for 18 months.
You got a frozen shoulder, okay,
yeah.
Good. Okay, so I like a good challenge. Actually, that's not that much of a challenge. And there's several principles here. I mean, one thing, and this is just generally, if a person comes to me and says, I really would like to be exercising, and I've got an ankle, a knee, or a hip that's really giving me a lot of trouble, and that gets worse, the more I walk, the more I run, the more I walk or the more I run, that gets worse and worse and worse. The first thing that comes to my mind is that this person ought to be doing a different kind of exercise where they're not weight-bearing on the leg. Does that make sense?
So like swimming or something.
Or
well,
bike.
Swimming,
or bike.
Bicycling,
okay.
The rowing machine, there's a lot, I don't know whether, I can't picture what an elliptical trainer is like, but is your body weight down?
It's that one
like
you're going like this.
Okay, but that probably still can, your body weight is still down on it. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's
sort of, but you don't impact.
It keeps you
right. From impacting.
And one strategy you could take with this would be that just in general, you could save, I think of the idea of saving the activities that are going to bother you for something you really want to do. For example, do your training at home on an exercise bike, and then when you come up here and you want to go hiking, go ahead and go hiking. But save, do most of your training without putting weight bearing on your hip. Now, the other thing, this is, I'm a little bit hamstrung with your hip because I don't know, couldn't really investigate it. But there's one form if the pain is out in the lateral hip and the outside of the leg, one thing that really helps that a lot, one thing that a lot of people who have that is very weak abductor muscle. And that's the muscle that takes your leg out this way.
Okay.
And if you could, the way you could test that, you could lay on your side, hold your leg up in the air like that, and have your husband or somebody try to push it down. A person has normal strength of that muscle, you just cannot push it down. If yours goes down like butter, or if it hurts, then that could be a part of the reason you're having a lot of pain.
You have to make sure when you're doing that, you hold your pelvis steady. In other words, don't... arch up so that, you want to just hold it nice and steady and just move out from the hip.
Now, the people who have this complex, what I have them do is I have them, even people who are sedentary, who are not exercising, the first thing I have them do is start riding an exercise bike because they get a lot of increase in circulation from cycling but they're not putting their body weight down on it. And that's really helpful. The other is to start a strengthening program for this muscle, the one that takes it out. And actually, if it is this real distinct lateral hip pain, I suggest you see a physical therapist for it. Because they may be able to, that's something that, I would say that's one of those things that's kind of a slam dunk
that's
to treat.
That's still right. Is that I still
That's okay.
Well, that's starting to feel pretty good.
What's a recumbent
yes,
like?
Just put it like a chair.
The thing about a recumbent bike, I can tell you, is that for certain types of people who have back pain, it's harder recumbent bike, it's harder for disc pain and from the back. It's because the spine, whenever you're in a sitting position, or your trunk is in a flexed position, the pressure on the disc is a lot higher. So, generally speaking, for most of my patients, I prefer a regular bicycle over the recumbent.
See, and I get paid when I go on a regular bike.
Yeah, and so that's telling you that so the recumbent bike is. That's why I say generally that's the case. Okay. There are certain kinds of back pain and things like that where being in the recumbent position is actually easier for you. That's overly technical.
Mitch, it was the adductor, not the abductor that you were talking about, right?
No, it's the abductor.
It is the abductor?
Right. Okay. Yeah. That abduct means to take away, like to abduct something, or abduct somebody is to kidnap them. Okay.
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 Was there any abductor? Was there anything else that you said that?
And bike instead of walk. And no, that would be my recommendation for you. Okay.
Except for see a PT.
Now, this is one where I really would recommend it. And also, is your shoulder still bothering you?
Well, I had almost full range, and then they discontinued my therapy. So I'm losing mobility again.
Did they give you home exercise?
Yeah. So.
At least for the hip, you should. That's something they can probably help you.
Because in the past they just said, "Oh, let me give you cortisone."
Practice now.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody? Another situation or question?
I have one. I was really proud of myself this year because I've always walked and I bicycled with my husband's son and skied with his, just like one trip or two years ago in Houston. But this year I took up tennis. I was watching my daughter play tennis and take lessons, and I thought, that looks fun. So I started with tennis lessons, and I was doing a 1 hour lesson a week, and that was cool. And then I started playing on a Friday morning late evening. That was cool. And then I started adding an extra game in. Well, then all of a sudden, my hip and my arm, my shoulder started hurting, and I realized there was probably something else I should have done here besides just play tennis 3 times a week.
Yeah.
To build up those muscles. And so what I wanted to know is, how do you find out, if I'm going to, the same thing happens. My husband and I will do bike trips. We'll ride, several hundred miles over a trip. And, I'll ride with them, but I probably should be doing some other kind of muscles to prepare for that weight
exercise. Yes, and it's the specificity principle. It's and this is a really good point. And that is, for repetitious activities where you're wearing out, one particular part of your body, a lot of times you do have to do some specific training to get you ready for it. Now, the one thing about tennis and golf both, there's a lot of trunk rotation, or a lot of twist in it. And that's a problem. The other thing about tennis as opposed to walking and stuff like that is generally in tennis you're doing a lot of side-to-side, this kind of stuff, as opposed to just, walking in a straight line. I'm not supposed to go past that beam. It's supposed to be this original barrier because of the microphone.
Field.
So, what's that?
Force field. Mm-hmm.
Right. And you also have to use your shoulder, especially one shoulder. You have to use it an awful lot. So what I could, what you can do is there are specific conditioning exercise programs specifically for tennis, and I would be willing to bet that they're even if you call the USTA that they're even published.
So I looked on their website. I've looked in some tennis magazines, and I haven't seen it. That's what I was wondering.
But generally speaking, the approach I would take with a tennis player, you need to have strong quads. I do some quadricep strengthening. That would be the straight leg raises. And if you don't have knee pain, I'd also do some from a standing position, do some bends like this. I'd also do the leg on your side and lifting your leg out this way. That strengthens these stabilizing muscles. And then you do kind of a progression where you start people just doing this. And you work up, to like this to build up stability in your hips. And that'll help. And then there's you should also do just some routine stretching of your shoulder, of course. But the other thing is you actually do need to do strengthening of your shoulder. And particularly for tennis, the rotating muscles of the shoulder. So they have, if you want to look in a club, they have machines that...
Or what about just TheraBand or something?
Yeah, or just elastic.
Well,
that's something I could do at home. Is that adding in a trip to the gym?
Yeah, if you, how would she do that? She'd hold the piece of elastic.
Yeah, usually just tie the elastic to the wall and this way, and then turn around so that you're going this way, like that. And then just Z stretching, you know, just making sure that, you know, stretching like
this. With the rubber band.
Right.
Yeah.
And I will say this, is that stretching, I feel, has been way oversold for prevention of injury. You see tons about stretching. The thing you have to remember about stretching is that when you stretch muscles, it also makes them weak. Mm. The more you stretch them out, the weaker they get. And in my practice, I do very, very little stretching. I do some stretching, but I do a ton of strengthening. Mm-hmm. And the bulk of my approach for rehabilitating joints is to do lots and lots and lots and lots of very light activity. Like, for example, the frozen shoulder, I have my patients doing around 1,000 repetitions a day of without any resistance at all, just rotating the shoulder up and back. And for somebody who's going to play tennis, I mean, think about tennis. You're not taking one gigantic tennis ball and one time picking it up and throwing it over the net. You're doing it 100, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And that's the way you want to train for it. So officially, I think we have to stop the tape. But chapel's not for a while. And I'm really happy to sit in for a while and keep chatting or
actually,
answering.
Actually, I can't remember why, but Vespers is at 8 tonight.
We have a staff meeting.
There's a staff. It's not kidding.
There's a sing-along.
So the staff disappears.
You're officially excused, then you can go go in good grace. But if you want to hang around for a bit more, I can also.
What about, I have a lot of problems with lower back pain. I cannot do something bending over. If I have something that I have to work at, I have to put it on the table, and because I'm afraid that I'm going to not get able to straighten up, and this happened. I walk, I have a walking program, something like he talked about, but I have no other program. What can I do? Is there something I can do to...
And you stretch every morning.
Yeah.
How does your back do when you walk? Does it feel good or bad?
Doesn't bother me to walk.
For about 90% of problems with the low back involve the discs in your back, and your body is actually trying to tell you something when it hurts you when you bend over like that.
You're not supposed to be bending over.
The pressure in the inside of the disc, when you're in this position, when you're standing up like this, is about 30 pounds per square inch. Mm-hmm. When you get down to here, it's about 600 pounds per square inch of pressure. And the common way that you get into trouble with the disc is that it either flattens out under pressure or it actually ruptures. Some of the liquid part in the middle of it actually kind of squirts its way through. So one thing is, there's volumes of books written about how to do things without bending it, without bending forward, you know, so that's one part of it.
And it's actually great that you take something to a table and don't bend over. That's right. I mean, if I bend over and I'm taking stuff out of the dryer, Mitch will come by the laundry room and say, use your legs, not your back. Yeah. I mean, so... What's that? Yeah, bend your knees.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, there's some things that sometimes
you have to do. Right.
Yeah. And for example, our grandchild, who is, I suppose, 5-6 pounds, I living over, put him in the swing. Quick, take this baby. I can't get up. You know.
Right. Well, the two things that you could that generally help that, and one thing you might think, well, if I'm having trouble bending over, what I really ought to do is practice bending over and stretch and really get where I can really bend over forward. Okay. And that's a fatal concept, because that actually, you'll actually make yourself worse gradually by trying to increase the amount of flexion in your back. The strategy that helps is periodically, I usually have my patients about every hour just kind of lean back and kind of gently stretch backwards like this. And the other thing I have them do is try to increase the strength in their back muscles. And usually that's the thing that if there is a hope for you to get where when you're at the extreme of flexion, you're not hurting, the best hope of accomplishing that is to really strengthen your back extensor muscles so that your muscles are actually a little bit stronger and tighter so that when you bend forward, they actually don't let all that compression happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
In other words, what's if I can draw a little picture. A lot of times when my patients tell me it hurts them when they bend at the waist, I say, good, good. That's because you shouldn't be doing that. But okay, this is the normal, this is a, the normal contour of the spine. This would be, your head would be up here. This would be your knee and your foot, okay? And what you notice is there's just a really slight backward curve. And along this are your vertebral, the vertebral bodies set like this. And in between them is the disc. Now if you looked at the disc, you cut straight through the disc and you look at it like this, it's like a jelly donut. In the middle of it, there's a liquid in here. Back here, this would be the little button that you feel. You feel your back. And in the center here is the spinal cord, and then of course the nerve that comes out that goes down and, you know, that goes down to innervate your leg. Now this liquid center is enclosed by sheets and sheets and sheets of fiber. They're called annular fibers because it actually looks like a tree. When you cut a tree, it looks like the annular rings on a tree. And these rings or sheets of fiber, what it looks like from the side, this would be one vertebral body, the other vertebral body. This is the liquid part. And then there's these fibers that run at an angle like this, both directions. And you know, in a way you can think about it, if you took a little bit of water, a little bit of Jell-O, and you took a balloon and put it over it and tied it, and then another balloon, and another one, and another one, and another one, until you built up a thickness about like that. And what you'd have is a structure that had a little bit of cush to it, but also would act a little bit like a swivel or a pivot that would let your spine move in different directions. Okay? Now when you get vertical pressure down on that, that puts this under a lot more pressure. And what happens at a certain time in your life, and it's actually towards the middle of your life that people have the most trouble with these. If you want to look at acute back pain, you start in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and you were going to graph it, it's kind of like this. Most people have the worst back pain in the decade, or the most trouble with their backs in the decade of their 30s, and eventually the spine just kind of all mushes together and it doesn't cause any trouble anymore. You with me so far?
Yep.
Okay, good. Okay, so what happens is sometime in your life, and maybe in your 30s, maybe in your 50s, whatever, these fibers start to get weak. And when you start to bend forward, what will happen is you get a little rush or jet out of these fibers. Now if it goes forward, there's nothing up here for it to push on, and so it doesn't really cause any trouble. Same thing if it goes out to the side, it doesn't really cause any trouble. But if it comes straight backward, there's a ligament here, the posterior ligament of the spine, and it's very sensitive. And that will give you that kind of piercing, deep back pain. If it keeps coming out even farther, it can actually start to push on the nerve that comes out, and that's where you get the lancinating pain. That's sciatica, that's the lancinating pain down your leg. Well, when you're having that pain that's worse when you're bending forward, worse when you're sitting, it feels pretty good when you walk, chances are what you've got is one of these. It's bulging out just a little bit, like that. And when you are bending forward, it's putting weight on this, increasing the pressure, which is just making this thing bigger, like that. And that's what's making it start to hurt. That's why I say that keeping trying to ram yourself into flexion is not going to make it any better. It's eventually going to make it worse if you do that. If you strengthen the muscle that bridges this right here, it actually starts to get to be like the string of a bow. You know, like a bow and arrow?
Mm-hmm.
Like that. It's the tension of the string that keeps the bow. And what you'd like to do is you'd actually like to have your back get a little stiffer, and you'd like to have this muscle get really, really, really strong so that when you bend forward, it won't actually let.
It doesn't move that curve.
It doesn't let the weight come down. Because when you bend forward at the waist like this, what happens is these vertebral bodies come together like this. And that's what really increases the pressure and just really squashes them down.
How do you strengthen that muscle?
I'll show you in just a second because I've got to get on the floor to show you. But the other thing, the exercise that is overwhelmingly the most highly correlated with improving back pain is aerobic exercise.
So the walking you do is excellent.
And the reason we think that is for a couple of reasons. One is, as you walk, your leg comes back and it kind of accentuates that curve in your back, and it reduces the, each time you take a step, you get a little reduction of the disc pressure. It kind of sucks the disc back in a little bit. It also, each time you take a step, your back muscles have to contract and relax, and so it actually strengthens your back muscle. Now, there have been a lot of studies of different kinds of machinery to try to strengthen the back, and almost all of them involve moving the back through an arc of motion under a load. So you might be bent over something and coming up like this under a load, or a tensioning machine where you're extending against a load. And the thing that's interesting about these studies is they had to discontinue them all because so many people were getting hurt doing the studies. And one thing we learned from those studies is it's a bad idea to move the spine under a load. The spine, in a static way of moving, you can put a lot of load on it, but if you load it and move it under a load, it's really dangerous for the spine. It can really hurt it.
Do you want me to show them quadruplets?
Yeah, in just a second. But what aerobic exercise does is as you're walking, you're having to, each time your heel hits the floor, you've got to contract those back muscles. It strengthens the back muscles and you know, you get this kind of bowstring effect, plus it also keeps them from getting tight. It gets the circulation through there. So if I were you, what I would do is I would walk and I'd strengthen the back extensors. And what you could do, the quadrupeds and that upper back extension.
Do you want to show this one, or just...
Just this, you know, the alternate arm.
Okay. So you want to alternate arms like this, and then you alternate legs like this.
And then when you get good at it, you can do an arm and a leg at the same time.
I haven't practiced this in a while. Actually, I should be doing this because I have the same back stuff that you do.
And then the other is the upper.
I should be doing it more.
I'll show you this one too. It's just...
All on the floor.
And then just coming up like this.
Mm-hmm. That feels so good.
Yeah, it does.
Now,
how much, how many repetitions, the more you... I mean, you start out and do it and keep trying to do more? Or?
Yeah. You want to exercise to fatigue. I usually recommend 3 sets to fatigue.
Okay. So the first time you can do it 10 and keep building until you can do it 20. And then at some point you can add...
You can put weights in your hands. And
yeah, so instead of doing 100, you can add some weight when you get to 30 and then drop back to 10.
Yeah, you said stretching. You said before I get up in the morning, somebody told me that, you know,
to pull your
knees,
yeah.
And I do that, first one maybe, then the other, and then I took
it. At best, that's not going to do any good, and at the worst, it's going to do some harm.
Doing that anyway.
Well, you know what, though? There are some, for some types of backs,
right,
that
right.
is a good stretch. The type of back you're describing, it's not. So that's kind of the problem when sometimes it's great to be able to share information, but if you're sharing it and two people have back pain and it's really two different things, then what's going to be good for this person isn't necessarily going to work for you. And so that's kind
of... Exactly. There is this tendency to think of back pain, all back pain is alike, and it's not. There are different kinds of back pain, need a different approach. And yours is the most common, and you fall into the right category. It's worse when you bend forward, and it's better when you walk. So I feel fairly safe in giving you that advice. I'm not giving that advice to everybody.
How do you know when back pain is something that I just need to, okay, just imagine I'll do some strengthening exercises, and when it's something that you should go to the doctor or...
Okay, well, let's talk about, first of all, what's an emergency for your back. And that is, if you're having in both legs, very big shocking pain, like you're having tingling and numbness that's very, very pronounced, very, very uncomfortable, and kind of scary in both of your legs, That's fairly urgent. If you're losing control of your bowels or bladder, that's a medical emergency. And that is, you can blow a disc that goes directly posterior and puts pressure on the spinal cord, and you actually start involuntarily voiding your bowels or bladder. And that's a true emergency. Also, if you notice that your foot is slapping when you walk, or if your leg is giving, you know, you've lost the strength in a muscle in your leg, that's fairly urgent, okay? Other than that, nothing else is an emergency for the spine, because 80% of the acute problems of the spine are going to get better over time.
Now, some things, like for a trunk shift,
yeah,
you're not in medical danger, but you're going to be really uncomfortable until you can see somebody who can help straighten it out.
I guess the first question is, like, what would I rush to the doctor and go to the emergency room?
I'm talking about the chronic stuff that, you know, okay, after 2 months you don't do anything and it's still there, but it's 3 months.
Well, generally, we know that about 80% is better in 3 to 6 weeks. If you're having significant back pain that's lasted longer than, you know, I really like to start getting people in after, if they, you know, starting with having no back pain and then starting with an episode of back pain that's lasting longer than 3 or 4 weeks, I start to like to get them in and start to make an intervention with them.
Well, when somebody comes to you, they usually been to the doctor first, and the doctor's going to review it?
Most of the time they've been screened first. And there's some important things that need to be screened out. You know, for example, you could have a kidney infection. I had a patient last year that had a spinal tumor, you know, that drove everybody.
That's very rare. So if you're having back pain, don't assume that it's a spinal tumor.
The visit to the doctor is important. I mean, it is important to get. And it also, a routine x-ray, that rules out cancers and infections and stuff like that, it's a good idea to do that, you know, especially the first time you're having back pain. But it's also kind of a cost-benefit ratio. There is a lot that you can do for somebody in the very first, you know, I used to have a practice that was right next to a hospital emergency room, and we had a real good relationship with the emergency room physicians. And when they had people who came in acute back pain, we used to see them right out of the emergency room. See them in PT, and most of what we did for them was, you know, forcing their trunks into a little bit of extension, getting them on their feet, and getting them walking.
Extension meaning this instead of this.
And we treated about 5 to 10 patients a week over 4 or 5 years, and we never had a serious complication from it. And our average patient was able to be walking 45 minutes or an hour after the three or four days after they first hurt themselves. So you can take a very, very active approach to with the back that actually gets you through it really quickly. What we know from research is that resting, particularly bed resting, more than a day or two of bed resting, it begins to negatively affect the long-term outcome. In other words, if you rest, there's a measurable difference in the long-term outcome after just a couple of days of bed rest. And so if you're still having bed rest after a day or two, I would want to get help.
If you're having this the kind of nagging chronic stuff, you know, what I would do after having lived with him for years is just do the stuff that we're talking about. Make sure you don't bend over for anything. Use a lumbar support or roll up a towel. Use your sweatshirt. Always, if you're sitting, put something on your... If you're having the kind of pain where it's worse if you're bending over, just try that. Try to do some of these back bends. Try to do that each day. Do a lot of walking every day. Build in a walk. And I bet you pretty quickly it will start to feel better.
Mine isn't bending over, actually, or walking. It's not pain. Mine's more just...
That's a different kind of. It sounds, that's usually typical of joint pain, mm-hmm. Pain in these little facet joints.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually,
that's the kind of back pain that responds really well to being stretched physical therapists, we do kind of low-grade manipulation for it. We kind of an oscillating manipulation. That really helps a lot. And also strengthening your back at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of chiropractors?
For acute back pain, there's pretty good evidence There is good evidence that manipulation, regardless of who does it, a physical therapist, an osteopath, or a chiropractor, for treating low back pain, it's got such a favorable, what we call a natural history, that is, if you leave it alone, it gets better so rapidly. It's very difficult in research, and they've done research on all kinds of stuff, like ultrasound machines, electric stem machines, hot packs, cold packs, all this, and medications, narcotics, and all this kind of stuff. And there's almost nothing that does better than the natural history of low back pain. In other words, if you just had left it alone. However,
except for not resting, right. Like some people, you know.
Well, resting too much actually does worse than the natural history. That actually can make it worse. But manipulation of the spine does slightly better, as does this exercise program that I showed you. Is about equivalent with chiropractic. Also, education. This brief little pamphlet that just sort of goes through what I just went through with you, that also does better than the natural history of back pain. And getting people started doing light aerobic activity early on, that also does better than natural history. You remember I talked to you about, how many of you were here the first session? Yeah. Remember I was talking to you about with cardiovascular disease, there's all these little things that make a little tiny bit of difference. There's my experience, I haven't actually done an I would really like to do this study, but my sense, because this is what I do clinically when I work, is I combine a lot of those things. I combine, you know, mobilizing or manipulating the spine with exercise, plus a lot of education, teaching people how to sit, how to walk, and how to take care of themselves. And all of that together seems to make a really big difference. And if you've got, I think in the best of all possible worlds, you know, as soon as people, the very moment that people were hurt, I think it would be good for them to see somebody to help them out that knows what they're doing. However, I realize that the doctor visit, coming to see a physical therapist, is very, very expensive. And the point at which it seems like, from an economic point of view, it seems to kind of balance out would be, the 3 to 6 week mark is where, and that's where most of our patients are referred to us, you know, usually in the 3, 4, 5 week period. You know, they're not improving on their own. They're not getting out of bed. They're still stuck in a resting pattern. That's when they get referred to us. However, if it was me, if I was laying in bed and couldn't get out of bed, I just had surgery on my neck. I had my parathyroid removed, and I was feeling pretty bad after a couple of days in bed. And for me, I'd want to get help sooner than that. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, I did have.
Other people who want to go, please feel entirely free to go. I mean, you're.